Blue Psy Radio Show, Tuesdays from 4 on CAM FM. Visit bluesci.org for more information.
Hello, and welcome to the very first Blue Psy Radio Show on CAM FM. I'm Anand Jagatia. I'm here today with Lizzie Bateman. How are you, Lizzie?
I am very well, Anand. How are you?
Not bad. Yeah, no, good. I'm very well, yeah. Very happy to be here. Today is our inaugural show. The theme is about the science of memory and amnesia. Something which interests you, Lizzie, is it?
Yeah.
Do you have a first memory? People often say that their first memory is from when they were very, very young, but I don't really believe them. I mean, if you are a baby and you have a memory of your mother leaning over your cot or something.
I certainly don't have that memory at all.
What is your first memory? My first memory was when I was like 3 or something. Maybe I was just a really stupid kid.
No, I think mine's even later than that.
11.
I'm thinking like 5 or 6.
I don't know what age babies have to be before they can actually form memories. I mean, maybe we'll never know. So today, we were talking about amnesia. That's the main feature. In particular, the study's done on a very famous patient called HM. A bit later on, but right now, it's time for the news. So what's in the headlines this week, Lizzie?
Okay, well, first, we have gonorrhea. The sexually transmitted disease, gonorrhea, is becoming increasingly drug-resistant. The BBC has reported yesterday that the antibiotic usually used by doctors to treat gonorrhea is becoming ineffective, as the bacteria causing the infection is less susceptible to it. Doctors are going to be told to stop using the drug normally prescribed and have switched to using more powerful antibiotics. However, the Health Protection Agency has warned that the disease may soon become incurable unless new treatments are developed.
So is
Doesn't
that
sound good?
No, I think it might be because of an overuse of antibiotics.
I hear that generally, that in medicine today, overuse is one of the biggest problems in terms of growing resistance
concern.
And things.
The latest satellite data from scientists has shown them that the UV emissions from the sun may be contributing to the change in winters in Northern Europe. Recent colder winters, I mean, did you notice this? It was pretty cold last winter.
Not particularly, I don't know.
I found it very chilly, but anyway.
My grandma said it was particularly cold, and I think grandparents seem to
know. Grandparents know about the weather. Recent changes in some parts of the world, but warmer winters elsewhere may be caused by the change in the UV output of the sun, which is now thought to be far more variable than previously estimated. Scientists have said, however, that this has no impact on global warming. Average across the planet, there is no effect on global temperatures. So it's not actually going to... it's not a problem, so to speak, Lizzie.
It is for my grandma. I think she'll disagree with that. I've got an interesting one here. So engineers from Wisconsin in the US have developed a way of harnessing the energy from the airflow in your nose to create electricity. Nose power.
What, just from
basically.
Literally just breathing?
Literally just breathing. They've done it by taking advantage of something called the piezoelectric effect.
So, what does that even mean, Lizzie?
Huh?
What does that even mean, Lizzie?
Well, here we go. Some materials, such as the one used by the team... It's called, I'm going to say this wrong, polyvinylidene, I think. It can build up an electric charge if mechanical stress is applied to them, such as from the airflow from human respiration. So by making the material thin enough, the small vibration which this causes could be used to generate enough power to run biomedical devices such as pacemakers, which is pretty cool that you can make electricity just by breathing deeply. I find that pretty cool.
Yeah, I suppose because it's not going to any good use, is it? Unless you warm up your hands in the cold, maybe then you'll wish that your pacemaker could just have a battery. But otherwise, I think it's very clever. I have one more story, which is that recently everyone knows that teenagers need more and more sleep. There's always a study saying that they don't get enough. But teenagers who sleep in might be doing themselves some good. Researchers have suggested that lack of sleep during adolescence especially may prevent balanced wiring of the neurons in your brain. Scientists found that sleep restriction in adolescent mice might prevent appropriate formation of synapses between nerve cells. So that's just the connections that develop. I'm sure you know what a synapse is, but anyway. Is that your excuse then?
My excuse?
That you're for sleeping in and being very lazy? She was late to the studio today.
Oh, just woke up.
Yeah, it's 4 in the afternoon. Yeah, I sleep in this late. So 9 a.m. lecture, that was totally gone.
Mainly, but also I think mainly you're just quite lazy.
So basically, guys, sleep in as much as you can. This is what we're advocating on the science show.
No, we're not advocating.
Scientific
just,
backing.
It's literally objective knowledge. We're not advocating it. So for those of you who are just joining us, you are listening to the Blue Psy Radio Show from Cambridge's longest-running science magazine. you can BlueSide. You can log on to BlueSide.org or pick up one of our magazines for free, literally for free, from around the university. If you want to get in touch or leave us your comments at any time during the show, even now, literally now, you can contact us in real time. You can email us, studio@camfm.co.uk, or you can log on to www.camfm.co.uk, where you can also listen online. You might be doing that already, and fill out the web form and click send. So, next week, part of the show, what we're hoping to do is answer some questions from people that they send in about science. So, I mean, have you got any scientific questions which you want to know the answer to that you've always wondered, Lizzie? Like, why is the sky blue? Something like that.
That was literally my question. Yeah. Why is the sky blue? Actually, though.
I thought you were a physicist. Aren't you supposed to know about that sort of thing?
That's... No. No. Oh, don't put me up here, Alan. No. I'll find out. I'm sure most people wonder why and don't actually know.
Somebody just sent in a message saying, what is a synapse? Well, a synapse is the... harking back to our new story earlier, it's an electrochemical sort of interface, but not all. Sometimes they can be purely electrical, but it's basically an interface between two nerve cells, and it's how they communicate with each other. So they can send each other sort of chemical signals, and they're interpreted at various strengths to make a synapse, switch on and off, etc., etc.
Wow, that was not scripted at all. That was straight.
The whole show is improv. There are no scripts.
That is impressive.
So anyway, what I was hoping was that if you're listening now, if you'd send in some questions, or just during the week if you think of them, you can email radio@blueside.co.uk, or you can send them to CamFM on the web form if you're listening now. Then we will scour the university for academics and read up in all the latest journals and thumb through textbooks to find you the answer.
But we shall work tirelessly for you guys.
Yeah, we will. It has to be a good question, though. If it's rubbish, then game
over.
I'll
answer it then.
Lizzie will answer rubbish questions. It was interesting. But yeah, no, we'll pick a couple. If you feel like you would like to know anything about the world, let us know. So, we come now to the main event, which is our feature. Early this week, I was having a chat with Benedict, very good friend. You know Benedict, don't you, Lizzie?
I know Benedict.
Good friend. About amnesia. And, basically, it was very interesting. He's a very clever boy, and he said lots of interesting things. So, this is what we talked about. So, Benedict asked me, when I told him we were going to be doing a show about amnesia, whether he could make the rather obvious and droll joke of, so I forgot, what were we talking about? But I expressly forbade him to mention it.
I have no memory of asking you to do that whatsoever.
amnesia, everyone knows what amnesia is. There's loads of films about it.
There's films like Memento.
I've not actually seen
it. I've never seen that one. And what's the one about the pianist who gets lost in Canada? Is that Memento? I don't know. There's one about a pianist.
Yeah.
Who loses his memory.
And the Bourne films, the Jason Bourne films, which I do remember. Mm-hmm. And there's always a weird dichotomy in those films where they can remember some stuff and they can't remember other stuff. And it's sort of it's not they're starting again. It's sort of a bit of a contradiction. How does it work actually? Like, is that how it works?
Well, having never seen the films, it's very difficult for me to say. But my guess is that, as with most films and most popular culture, the science behind it is pretty kind of so they consult scientists, and then they base the film on what the scientists have said, but mostly ignore all their advice because it doesn't actually make a good film. It's not conducive to a good plot line. That's my experience of this. So I think we have to, if you've seen these films, you kind of have to work on the basis that it's not necessarily true, and that it's really for dramatic effect a lot of what they've put in.
Yeah, but saying that, I suppose if you're amnesic, then that's pretty dramatic. I mean, you're not gonna, you can't remember anything.
It's a dramatic subject, which is, I suppose, why it's captured the attention of so many directors and filmmakers. But The other thing is, I suppose, every case kind of manifests itself differently because the brain is so complicated and because there's so many little bits that can go wrong. So perhaps, although there might not be a real case, clinical case, like what you've seen in the films like Memento or the Bourne films, it could well be that they are actually possible given the right lesion in the brain.
Yeah, so I was doing some research, and there are two... When you think of memory loss, there are... The amnesia can be divided into two main types. So you've got anterograde amnesia, which is when you have the inability to lay down new memories, and also retrograde amnesia, which is sort of more like what happens in the Bourne films, when he's fine, but he can't remember anything, certain events in his past up to a certain point, yep, from the moment when he wakes up in the sea, about his life. So... I mentioned earlier we were going to be talking about patient HM, who is arguably the most famous study.
Certainly to neuroscientists and psychologists, yeah, he's the most famous one, yeah.
His full name is Henry Gustav Mallesen. I think that's how you say it. But you're not, when patients like that are still alive, you're not allowed to refer to them by their full name. But he was an anterograde amnesic, and he basically just couldn't... lay down any new memories. He lived his life within a brief, sort of maybe 2 minute window, and mm-hmm. just on repeat.
He'd forgotten all his past, or of his past, had he?
No, so he was an anterograde amnesic.
So he hadn't actually.
Yeah,
forgotten
so
much
he,
of his
he thought he, so. The point he remembered about 3 months of his life before he became amnesic, he could not remember. But after that, he thought it was 1953 or something.
And was stuck in that 1953 moment.
Yeah, and so if you talked to him and then you walked out of the room, he wouldn't have met you. He'd talk to you perfectly normally, mm-hmm. Which is the interesting thing. But then he would just forget that he'd spoken to you and just start again, basically.
Just have a complete blank that he never met you before. We'll talk about it later, I'm sure, but there's various tasks that the scientists who studied him got him to do, and he could learn the tasks, but he'd forget ever having done the task in the first place, which is another really strange kind of way to be.
It's very odd to think that your life... I mean, your sense of self, your whole, the way you are is built obviously on memories. Like, if you can't remember who you are, then you don't know who you are. So sort of HM is sort of stuck in the version of himself that he currently lives in, that there's no room for personal growth in his life. There's no opportunity for him to make or sustain new friendships, or it's very, I mean, I think that must definitely be the reason why amnesia is such a intriguing topic, because...
Yes, yeah. So why is HM so famous? Why is he so well known as the kind of the classic case of amnesia?
Well, I think he was one of the first... he contributed, I think, to one of the first sort of revolutions in thinking about memory and the way that memory works in the brain. So he was epileptic from a young age. He was quite a dashing chap, actually. Have you seen a picture of him?
I haven't seen any pictures, though.
He looked like... he was epileptic from a very young age, and he... to the point where it was compromising his quality of life. He couldn't sustain a job. He had seizures a lot. And a surgeon called William Scoville basically just removed parts of his brain. He removed both... medial temporal lobes, which are the that's a structure which contains your hippocampus, your amygdala, and also an area of cortex called the rhinal cortex, and they just basically removed it, which cured his epilepsy, but it very quickly became clear that he had severe memory problems. So he still remembered things that had happened in his life. He remembered events and things which he'd experienced before the operation, and his short-term memory was intact, so he'd be able to remember, for example, a string of 5-digit numbers, which is called a digit span test, or longer. He'd do very well on that, but then any element of long-term memory that required him to, you know, keep and consolidate those memories, he couldn't do yet.
So the actual kind of, I suppose, if you ask people about memory, the one you think of most is long-term memory of things that have happened in the past, and that was still intact, that was still there.
Yeah.
And also the memory that allows you to do tasks like remembering a phone number, for example, that was still there.
Yeah.
But the issue he then faced was that anything new that he learns doesn't get stored in his long-term memory, which is, although it's still intact, it's kind of sealed off from anything else being able to be put into it.
It's interesting, and the reason why he's he's a very famous case study is because, you know, he now we know, or we have a much more sort of refined taxonomy of the way memory works. And so, I mean, it makes sense. So basically what people have decided is that there are two main forms of memory, declarative and non-declarative. So declarative memory is explicit, the sort of things that you, meanings of words and things which happened to him, but he was unable to form new declarative memories essentially. Right. So if I meet you, I'll remember that your name is Benedict. Mm-hmm. Whereas he'd know that, but then he wouldn't remember that. But there's a non-declarative memory is sort of more implicit. So skills like learning to ride a bike, associative learning and emotional memory, those things were all very much intact, like the sort of the things which happened, you know, I don't know, almost subconsciously.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, there were certain tasks which he was able to do very well. There's a task called the mirror drawing task, which have you done it? I mean,
yeah, that's the one where you're looking in a mirror and you have a pencil in your hand and there's, for example, like a star on the piece of paper in front of you, but you can't see that directly. You're just looking in a mirror and it's impossibly hard. You just have to kind of draw round the star, follow the contours of the star with the pencil, looking in the mirror. And it's really tricky to begin with, but then as you get going, you get better at it. And that's a really good example of non-declarative memory and learning those sort of tasks.
Yeah, because you're obviously forming memories to be able to complete them. So, I mean, you know, that people would say to him, oh, you know, come over here and, you know, have a go at this task. You're very good at it. And he would sort of say, well, I've never done it before in my life.
Right.
But he obviously had, and he was able to... That element of long-term memory was intact, and he was able to, you know, perform the task basically very well each time without ever sort of remembering, or he would deny that he'd ever done it before.
And you see a similar sort of effect in other amnesics who are tested, for example, in rule learning games with cards and weather forecasting, I think they've done.
Yeah.
And you can learn the rules because they form part of the non-declarative side of things. But again, they have no recollection of actually ever performing the task.
Yeah, so they sort of they get results, but they don't really realise how they're doing it. They just sort of if you see what I mean.
They think that they're experts without realising it. That's
yeah. So yeah, studying HM, the studies that were done on him have contributed to what we have nowadays, what people think of as the way memory works, which is there's dissociation between these different forms of memory and the different neural systems which interact to sort of produce them and create a cohesive sort of working memory system which you can then use to, you know, live your life. Whereas if you don't have that, which HM didn't, you're sort of stuck in this sort of loop. Another quite a famous example of a case study, somebody who was amnesic, was a guy called N.A. who one of my lecturers described as receiving a beautiful lesion by a perfect lesion by getting a fencing foil stabbed up, went straight up through his nose and just destroyed part of his brain, basically.
Very precisely.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, that's you know, trying to get you know, ethics approval on doing that.
It was clearly some scientist who wanted to do a test.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
There have been some other people as well. There's, you were telling me about
Clive.
Yeah,
Clive Waring was a British musicologist. Used to be quite high up on Radio 3, in fact, and did all the music things there. And he and I don't know what caused this. I think it may have just been very sudden, perhaps a stroke or something like that. Something caused a lesion in his brain. And he again has got this similar thing to HM, which is his anterograde amnesia. And his memory span is even shorter than HM's was. It's somewhere in the region of 7 to 30 seconds. His memory span. He still has the musical ability. He can still play the piano really well because that's unaffected. That's something he's already learned, and that's non-declarative anyway. But his wife, whenever she walks into the room, he thinks it's the first time he's seen her in years, and jumps up and greets her and hugs her. And he keeps a diary of everything so he can kind of look back. Well, he started keeping this diary, but found it was useless because he forgot that he'd written the previous entries in and would scribble them out because he didn't recognise his handwriting.
Who's done this?
And he thought it was someone else. And then he'd write exactly the same thing underneath 2 minutes later.
It's
a terribly sad condition. It really is.
It's weird because, I mean, it's on some level, it's like a lot of amnesics probably aren't aware that they're amnesic, and they sort of, it's not that they don't enjoy their life, it's just that they don't live a normal life by any means, but they sort mm-hmm. of they just carry on repeating the same sort of aspect of their life. But I think, sadly, I think Waring said the same thing, and HM, they sort of became gradually aware that they were there was something wrong with them. And I have a quote here from HM which says, every day is alone in itself, whatever enjoyment and whatever sorrow I've had. So, I mean, it's very unsettling. You sort of, it's just being completely at odds with the world, I guess. Like you know something is wrong somewhere, but you can't really do anything about it, and you forget that you've ever felt weird about it.
I mean, this is the strangest thing with brain defects and brain lesions, is that it's easy to forget or to not realize that your brain is you, and so if there's something wrong with your brain, you're not aware of that most of the time. You know, if it's affecting a very fundamental thing, the way your brain works, you feel as though that's just the normal way of living, and you're not aware that there's this error, and so everything can just be so so confusing for you, but you don't know. And so Clive Waringham, patient HM, and Jimmy G, who Oliver Sacks wrote about as well, who had also anterograde amnesia, they all move through their life and they make the same mistakes over and over again, and they make the same memory loss, they forget the same things. But they have no way of realizing they're doing it, and then I suppose it comes on as you see there with that quote that he does begin to click with HM that there is something, but still there's no way you can put his finger on it, because that is just his mind is like that. If you take déjà vu for example as well, that's another sort of thing, and no one's really sure how that works, but that's in everybody experiences déjà vu at least once in a while, and that is another fault in your brain, another error, but to you, because it's your brain doing it, it feels like you're remembering something from way back in the past. Because, I mean, I don't know if you know any of the theories for déjà vu. There's nothing concrete, but
no, I think what people think is that maybe there's a sort of a strong sense of recollection. You have the feeling of remembering something, but without any of the accompanying information of a memory, you're not really actually. You know, so if you have déjà vu, you feel like you've been there before, you've been in a situation before, but the details of that situation are very sketchy. You don't really have any actual idea about what's going to happen. So, I mean, it's very uncanny, because you feel as if, you know, it feels as if maybe somebody's tinkered with your brain and you've been there before. But like, I think I've read somewhere that it may be due to an overlap between your long-term memory and your short-term memory systems. So you might be in a new situation and you're forming. You know, stuff's going into your short-term memory systems because you're experiencing them for the first time, but also, you know, certain circuitry perhaps in your long-term memory being switched on, so that you feel as if you are remembering something that's actually happening for the first time.
So they're kind of out of phase, and there's feedback coming from your long-term memory that the short-term memory has forgotten it kind of sent to the long-term memory.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of idea?
I think
and so, it feels like an old memory when it's not, it's just happened.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe, you know, your brain is sort of, you're feeling like you're accessing a memory which you have already stored that doesn't actually exist. I think that's what some of the ideas are. Because when you have déjà vu, you don't actually think like, oh, I remember seeing that man before. It's more like, oh, I remember. It's almost like you're having déjà vu about having déjà vu. Like you feel like you remember something, but all you're having is the feeling of remembering something.
Or you feel like you dreamt about it. I often get, I feel like I've dreamt about that situation.
Yeah, that's
in the past. Which is obviously very unlikely. The number of times it's happened. I mean, it might happen once, I suppose. But I mean, the other option is we are kind of living in the Matrix, or there's some sort of physics slip going on.
Yeah, I think it happens when they chain something, Benedict. So do you think people will ever find out what it is that causes the déjà vu?
The tricky thing is, with all studies on the brain and all science to do with the brain, in particular, the neurology of the brain, you can't just go up to somebody and ask them to volunteer to do an experiment and pay them some money and go in and slice a bit of their brain up.
Because, I don't know, we're going to do a fencing if you want.
That just doesn't happen. You have to wait for somebody to come along with the relevant lesion and volunteer for them to, you know, be part of scientific study, which is why HM has become so famous.
And he donated his brain to science. I think
they've sliced it up, haven't they, all the way through, so they photographed it, and so you can kind of zoom through on screen. And so it's down to people like HM who kind of, I suppose, donate their bodies and their lives to science a lot of the time, that we're able to find out you know, for the last 50 years, he's driven a lot of the research based on memory and amnesia.
Right. That was my talk with Benedict about amnesia. What did you think, Lizzie? Were you listening?
Oh, I forgot. What?
Very funny.
Classic.
You've made
classic.
A fool of me. You've lampooned me on radio.
To be fair, I think I made a fool of myself then, just probably a bit more. So,
So anyway, earlier this week, yesterday, I interviewed author and astronomer Stuart Clarke. Stuart Clarke is got a PhD in astronomy, and he's a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society, on finding life in the universe, and also his new book, which is a historical fiction account of the lives of Johannes Kepler and Galileo Galilei, I think that's how you say his name, in the 17th century. More information of when you can listen to that is on our website, www.bluesci.org. Do you know anything about Kepler or Galileo, Lizzie?
I like to think I know a bit. I think...
What do you know?
I'd say most part 1B physicists are pretty sick of Kepler, actually. And his three laws, they're pretty important in orbits and planet motion. And Galileo, obviously, for his telescope and all sorts. But
yeah,
there is more about them, which I'd love to delve into right now. But obviously, I've run out of airtime. So
And knowledge. Ran out of things to say because you don't. But the book is actually... obviously, listen to the interview, but the book is good because it's fiction, so it's more about the people, and there is science in it, but it's a good marriage of the two. Right, we're going to talk about events this week, aren't we? So, blueside.org.co, no, just blueside.org, it's a really good website, and there's an events page on there, so you should use that if you like to go to science events, but we've picked out a handful of things that are going to go on this week. So there's a Science Sock event tonight, actually. I think the venue's to be confirmed. All about dark matter. So what is dark matter? Does it exist? How can we study it? What the future looks like. So,
I think I actually know what dark matter is. I know.
Yeah, what is it?
Well, basically, it's pretty weird stuff because it doesn't emit or scatter any electromagnetic radiation. So,
what's the point of it then?
What's the point? I'm sure
it doesn't do anything.
Actually, it makes up 23% of the mass energy density of the observable universe. Now, considering
what it makes up, or it is thought, it has been proposed to make up.
Well, considering that ordinary matter, which is you and me, table, only makes up 4.6%, it's a bit pretty of a big deal, you know.
Well, I thought that. It's not. This is actually something that Stuart Clarke was saying yesterday because he did a talk here. Dark matter isn't necessarily something which we know exists. It's just a way.
It's inferred, exactly.
Yeah, just because, you know, it's something. It is. Dark matter is the best way of explaining the odd movements of galaxies in the universe. Is that
yeah,
right?
I think
that's how it works.
No, basically, because you can't directly detect it via the usual methods, which is sort of optical and radio astronomy. It has to be inferred from the gravitational effects on visible matter. So, yeah, it's inference. So there's no
actual. So, yeah, I think so. Basically, stuff is moving towards each other quicker than we can account for.
So we get this thing, dark matter, and it sort of explains
it. Observable matter.
Exactly.
So dark matter sort of is. Oh, that's interesting. If you are a member of SciSoc, you can get into that talk for £2. If you're a member of SciSoc, it's free. If you're not, then it's £2. What else have we got this week?
Well, there's a talk from the Physics Society on the 100th anniversary of superconductivity. This is at the Plant Sciences Lecture Theatre and is £2 for non-members, but free if you are a member, so be a member.
Are you a member, Lizzie?
I'm not a member.
You do physics?
Yes.
The Physics Society.
Well, I get Physics Society emails, I get emails from everything, so...
This is obviously in the University of Cambridge. Yeah, that's Physics Society. I'm sure there are other physics societies like CERN or something. So you have to, even if you are a member of CERN, but not of Cambridge University Physics Society, you will still have to pay £2. So, I mean, I like conductivity, Lizzie, but if I had to pick, superconductivity is definitely better. So what is it, though? Because I have a friend who always tries to explain to me, but I never really listen.
And you need to tell me. You need to prompt me about these questions. But
no, but you must... isn't it... So if you cool... Oh, my God, do I know more about it than you?
Probably.
If you cool certain materials or something to near zero Kelvin, I think, which is absolute zero, I think, then they become really, really good conductors of electricity.
Superconductive.
I'm not sure, but so if that's wrong, then don't hold. But the resident physicist, Lizzie, doesn't know anything, so I had to sort of...
It's not been covered yet, I don't think.
Boring. So anyway, Friday... Wait, sorry, I think the talk from Physics Society is tomorrow, I think. But anyway, or maybe that's tonight. I don't know. No, tomorrow. So yeah, Friday, there is the fifth instalment, I think, in a series of seminars about science and policy, which the CSAP, which is the Centre for Science and Policy, which is based in Cambridge, actually, are running every Friday this term at 1 o'clock. Venue, I don't know where the venue is. I couldn't find it, but I think if you look it up, I think it'll be... maybe it's to be confirmed. The talk this week is entitled Post-Bureaucratic Public Services. I don't really know what that is. But if you do, or you want to know, then you should definitely go to this talk, because I think it's very important that people understand about how policy is influenced by science. Don't you agree, Lizzie?
I love politics.
Do you actually?
I really don't like it, no.
Oh, politicians.
No.
One final thing. The Blue Sky Squash, which is where you can meet the committee for the first time, if you want to join, get involved with Blue Sky, is on Monday, so next Monday, 17th of October, 7 p.m. in the Earth Sciences Common Room. Free food.
Always
a good incentive. So come down if you're interested in writing or editing or production.
Or just the free food.
Or radio. I'll be there. So even if you have no experience, actually, if you're a complete newbie, then just come down, because I think you can speak to some of the people who write for us regularly, and yeah, just if you have any questions, if you want to get involved. So it'll be a good event to go to. So next week, what have we got planned for next week, Lizzie?
We're going to delve into physics and the Large Hadron Collider.
You're going to dive inside the Large Hadron Collider?
I hope not. Although I will be telling you perhaps what would happen if someone did.
Oh, that's interesting, actually.
Well, I'm going to have to script it in now. But as well as the latest science news, but mostly on the LHC, and I'm sure most people have heard about it in the media, and, you know, is it a big waste of money? What is it actually showing us anything? Well, in fact, it is. It's showing us lots of stuff.
Wait, no, don't give away too much. You have to wait till next
lots
week.
Lots of stuff, hence generic stuff. You'll have to tune in to find out what this stuff is.
So tune in next week. so that's Tuesday at 4 o'clock, same time, to hear about the Large Hadron Collider. So, yeah, we'll also have the latest science news. We might even have a cheeky review in at the end of something, but that'll be a sort of a surprise. And
I think you might have ruined the surprise.
No, it's because how do you know what it's about? And also, if you have, we've had one question sent in today, which we already answered actually on about synapses. But if you have any questions that you'd like answering by somebody from the University of Cambridge, which is where we are based, then send in your question to radio@blueside.co.uk, and we will try and find out for you. But make sure to put in your name so that we can mention you. So did you manage to think of a question, Lizzie, that you'd want to answer as an example?
Oh, crikey. Well, actually, thinking back to the start of the show, when I asked why is the sky blue...
You figured it out.
I think I might have figured it out. Well...
Stop lying.
I say figured out, but I just remembered reading somewhere. I think it's something about the scattering of different wavelengths, and blue light gets scattered a lot more than red light when the sun's rays come through the atmosphere. Atmosphere scatters blue more than red, so we end up seeing the sky is blue, which is slightly different to the whole, what have I heard answers to that have been, it reflects the, no, this is why this, the ocean is blue, it reflects the sky, which is, I don't think, right, it surely would have, like, cloud-looking seas.
You're stalling, Lizzie. No, that was a very, very
that
good
was, I think,
actually.
Definitely scattering of wavelengths. Please correct me, everyone, if I'm wrong, which,
I
potentially.
Think it, I've heard similar stories, actually. On the grapevine, oh, did you hear that song?
Oh, gosh, no.
You don't know that song?
Well, maybe if you sang it. Try again.
Don't insult my singing.
Sing it again, Anand. I'd like to sing that again.
I'm definitely not singing, actually.
And then I won't interrupt either. You can carry on.
It's a gay song, isn't it? On the grapevine.
Go on, sing it.
I'm definitely not singing it. I feel very self-conscious now. You're a horrible person.
You started that, definitely.
Sadly, that is it from us this week. Are you sad, Lizzie? Are you sad?
Oh, pay attention.
Are you sad?
I'm so sad.
So Lizzie sad. I'm so sad. That's it from us this week. But tune in again at Tuesday at the same time. This show will also be available as a podcast, which you can download from, you guessed it, bluesci.org.
The BlueSci Radio Show from the university's longest-running science magazine.
For more information, visit bluesci.org.